talk about after it sunk, or the moment it sunk, what happened?
Well, after the port, the Cherokee sank and the Port Nicholson got hit with two torpedoes, the convoy continued on into Boston. One ship stayed behind and picked up the survivors of the Port Nicholson, and they stood by because the Port Nicholson did not sink. It stayed afloat throughout the through the night. The following morning, the captain and several crew members from both the Port Nicholson and the ship that they that picked up the survivors went back by small boat to the Port Nicholson to see if they could salvage the vessel and to see what the problem was, because they had already ordered salvage tugs out of Boston to come out and try to tow her back to shore. Well, they got over there, and when they got aboard, the captain went directly down. I think it was the captain and the chief first mate went down into Cargo Bay 3. Now, you would assume that the captain would go back to the bridge, get his log, and things of that nature, to his the manifest to what was on the ship, et cetera, et cetera. A couple of the guys went to the galley. Why they went to the galley, I guess they were hungry because they started making sandwiches. One guy stayed out on by the rail, keeping an eye on the boat that they came over across in. So the captain and the first mate was down in Cargo Bay 3 when they had just got down there. They were only down there a few minutes or so when the escort vessel that was there flashed the warning lights, sent a warning signal over to the people over there that this Port Nicholson was sinking rapidly because they could see it better than the people that were on board. So the stern started going down fast, and when that happens, the cargo bays, hatches, the hatches inside the ship, because of the pressures as it's going down, the water's coming in, started blowing the hatches off, and they could hear like explosions going boom, boom, boom. And so the guys in the galley got up and started running like hell, and they jumped off the side of the boat and got into the water. And they were climbing into the lifeboat that they came across in. Well, the captain and the first mate and another guy was still down in the ship when it went down. And one guy was outside, and the suction of the ship going down pulled him down with it. And so the captain, first mate, and another fellow went down, and they went all the way to the bottom with the ship. And so it was why when they went back there, I could see them going back to look at the ship to see if it could be salvaged, but you'd bring your engineers with you because those are the guys that took care of the mechanicals on the ship, the engines, the pumps, et cetera, et cetera. So why not bring them if you're going to think about salvaging a ship or keeping it afloat?
Was there time to get off the ship once they started hearing this stuff? Did they have to go down with it?
Well, it happened fast. It stayed floating for 6 hours overnight, so they assumed it was going to stay floating for a little longer. But then once those hatches started popping, it's letting more and more water in faster. And she just started popping, boom, one right after another. And it started flooding, and the stern went down, the bow went up into the air, and then she just twisted and turned, and down she went.
And that's a predictable thing, the common thing.
Yes, yes. And she hit the bottom of the ocean doing 35 miles an hour. So we think that on the way down, as she was twisting and turning, going down, some of the cargo came out of the torpedo holes that was down the side of the ship because it was close to the cargo bays. And there was a lot of cargo on deck. And an important fact is, people have to understand this, there was, everyone says that there was war materials on this ship, which there were. There was trucks and chassis and tires and things of this nature. But during 1942, it was in the height of the war, and Britain needed all the supplies it could get. It was being bombed. It was being over, you know, they were taking a beating. Now, why would they send war supplies over back this way? You would think that they would take everything that they could get, which we were sending stuff over there by the tons. But the Port Nicholson had war supplies on it coming this way.
The war wasn't over here.
Exactly. So could that, and we've got pictures of the Port Nicholson, and it shows that the water line is relatively high out of the water. So that tells you that it wasn't a fully loaded ship. Now, could the all these war supplies and trucks, which they were bolted, strapped down on the top deck, the outside deck, on, and was it a ruse? We don't know. We haven't found much inside that says that there's war materials on board. But if there was war supplies, why was it coming this way and not going back?
Is there any chance that the war supplies could have been removed between then and now?
No. No, they're laying on the bottom. No, nobody had been to that wreck until we found it. Because, you know, we've been all over, we spent the last 5 years sending our ROVs down there. We've studied every square inch of the outside of the vessel and surrounding the surrounding area. We've been into a couple of the cargo bays, but the cargo bay we want to go into, cargo bay 3, there's a lot of debris, pipes and things everywhere in the way, and we haven't been able to get inside of it.
But if it was so valuable, why wouldn't the government go down there and take it itself? Covertly? Or is it impossible to do covertly?
No, it's not. The U.S. government, well, any government could today go out and recover that. And we were extremely worried about someone doing that. That's why in the beginning, when we first put this project together, before I actually had any rights to it, the press in the U.K. had picked up something about it. How they did that, I'm not 100% sure. But this guy, this reporter, kept calling me. And he said, well, I'm going to print a story anyways. Well, so if you don't tell me, I'm going to print a story, and it may not be what you want. So to protect the identity of it, I came up with a kind of a fictitious name, and named the shipwreck the Blue Baron. And I said it was off the coast of Guyana. Well, it was basically to throw anybody off in this industry or any pirates or anybody else until we got some a federal claim on it, a maritime claim on it. And I didn't want to give any story out. I wanted to keep it as quiet as possible, but he was going to print a story anyways. So rather than have everybody following us, bugging us, I just gave him a story of, we'll say it was partially true because of the cargo and things like that. But I kind of mixed up the location and the name of the vessel. And he printed it, and then later on, he got the real story, so.
Are pirates and stuff a big concern in your industry? Would someone sweep in there and try to get it? Do you have to battle people for this?
Well, in the Caribbean, it's extremely prevalent, piracy. People turn up missing all the time. Their boat's gone. The pirates take their stuff off the boat, whatever's valuable, then sink the boat with the people on it, and then never heard from again, and nobody knows what happened. When you get out into, off the coast of the United States, it can happen. And if the cargo that we think is on board and worth what we think it is, what would a country do, or what would someone do for $3 billion to $10 billion?
So it's almost like the government is more concerning than pirates to you.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, you would think that your government would be happy that we found something like that, because think of the tax implications, how much money they would get, all these different things, the benefit that it would be. But I guess, the governments don't think the way that us normal people do.
And total speculation, that's if these war materials are like money. Is there anything else you could speculate that war materials would be on there?
Well, we know that there was trucks on the deck, boxes of ammunition, and some supplies, because we found them. We went out there and we recovered. We went down there. We've got videotapes of tires, truck chassis. We brought up the compass of the ship, which was pretty cool, because somebody in later years dropped depth charges on this thing, whether to destroy it or whatever. They thought it was a submarine, but they dropped a whole bunch of hedgehog depth charges on it, and it blew part of the bridge apart. And when they blew it apart, the ship's compass was blown off to the side, and we found it and we brought it up, and that was a pretty unique find.
Could these be classified? Could things be classified on there?
Yes. that could be one of the major reasons. I don't know. We have, like I said, until we get into the cargo bay to identify what was in there, it's a good possibility because it's just the location where they placed it, 20 miles from where it actually sank. The litigation that's been ongoing since then. So there's something on there that people don't want us to bring up.
Is that your responsibility to do that, to not bring it up in that case? Or you're a private citizen, right? You can do what?
Right. No, there's the law of salvage out there that says if you find something, you know, and nobody claims it, it's yours. When we first located the Port Nicholson and I filed a federal admiralty claim, I had to place notices in major newspapers. Now, normally, when you find a shipwreck, they tell you to place it in one newspaper. Like down in Key West, you'll read that somebody went out there and found a shipwreck, and they'll place it in the Key West Times, which is a small newspaper that says they found this wreck in this general area, and if anyone has a claim, come forward now, or you have 30 days to come forward and place your claim. Otherwise, you cannot come back and claim it later. Well, the courts here told me I had to do the same thing, but I had to do it in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Portland Press Herald, and I think there was one more. And it was extreme. I mean, it was like $16,000 for each newspaper to do this big notice. And I place a notice because that's the law, and that's what the court told me to do. Well, we did, and 30 days came and went. Nothing happened. No, didn't hear from anybody. And then later on, then the British came around. And then this other guy came around that said, from Massachusetts, that said he owned the rights to the whole ocean floor off of Massachusetts and the airspace above it and any shipwrecks or any minerals or anything else. So he filed a claim. Then he sent the judge a letter and asked him if he could borrow some money so that he could, you know, continue this fight. And he said, talked about, you know, that he was in this home for mentally challenged people and that, you know, if the judge could help him out in this and that. And then he sent the judge or the court pictures of flying saucers looking down at the ocean and stuff. Well, he's still in this case. Everything that's done, he has to get a copy of it. So, you know, that to me is like, you know, I can't go there.
How is that even legal if it's beyond 30 days?
Well, you know, that's what the law states. I did what the law states. And why they let him in after that is anyone's guess.
And this is the court that lets him in?
Yes.
So the U.S. court?
Yes, the U.S. court let them in. And basically when they let the British in, the British said that it was their vessel and that there was nothing on the vessel, no important cargo whatsoever. Well, they had 5 years to prove that. They have not in 5 years come forward with any documentation that said that they paid any kind of insurance claim. They said, well, it falls under the War Risk Insurance Act. Well, the War Risk Insurance Act, which is legitimate, it lists which vessels that it insured. Well, the Port Nicholson's not on that list. They have never in 5 years come up with any evidence that said that they have any claim to that vessel, yet I've had to litigate with them for 5 years in the courts. I mean, depositions one after another. It's cost us over $1 million to fight somebody that doesn't have a legitimate claim.
And their expenses are endless. They could fight.
Exactly. They have a deep pocket. So what do I do? I'm a small company in Maine trying to recover one of the richest wrecks in the world. And I have governments trying to stop me from doing it.
Do you feel protected by the U.S. government?
Protected? We probably better not answer that one. I'm staying at Charlie's house.
So, Greg, if I recall correctly from what I remember, it was a payment from Russia, the bullion, right, as part of their paying?
No, at first that's what we assumed happened. Okay. I just don't want to bounce too far because there's a lot to this. There really is. What we first thought it was, yeah, I know. Oh, At first, we thought it was war risk insurance payment, whereas... you asked me the question.
No, I know. Explain to Nick, because Nick's never heard this before.
Okay. At first, there was a program going on I can't remember what it's called.
It's called the
Lend-Lease program. Oh, there you go. Thank you. All right, there's a program called the Lend-Lease program where foreign countries would ask for assistance in supplies, etc., war supplies, food stores, medical things, and they didn't have the capital at the time to pay for them. So we lent them, we sent over the supplies, and they owed us the monies for it. So this was set up, and we did it with Britain. We did it with a lot of different countries. So we thought this was a repayment being shipped over. But since we first started doing this and reading through what I've read through, I don't think that it was a Lend-Lease payment. I think it was a covert operation, getting gold out of Russia and shipping it to the United States to launder it somewhere here in the United States. Because we found out through the New York Fed that, we'll say, 50 tons or so, close to what we thought it was, of gold was shipped during that time period. And they was expecting it at the New York Fed, but it never arrived. Okay, they don't say that it was on the Port Nicholson, but about the same amount of gold was listed that was supposed to arrive there during this time period that the Port Nicholson was supposed to get there, and it never arrived. So there's so much circumstantial evidence that places some valuable stuff on this vessel.
But why didn't the British go get it?
They don't own it. I filed a claim on it. It's just like any other thing. Governments aren't, we'll say, the best at everything. They don't follow through. They're not money makers. And if it was the case that they were doing a covert operation down there, we file a claim. Now it's public knowledge. It's been all over the world, this story. Now you can't come back and say, okay, well, it is on there, after they tried to keep me off of it, because I did everything by legally, everything. You never lose your rights to a shipwreck if you file a claim, if you do your due diligence. I mean, if you just say, I claim this and never do anything, then you'll probably lose your claim. Well, for the last, since 2006, we've done our due diligence. I mean, we're even doing our due diligence right to today because I'm trying to protect what we file and what we claim, because until we get inside that wreck, it's going to be unknown that what valuable cargo is aboard. Is it a military secret? Don't know. Is it bullion? I think it is. But until we get inside and remove it, we won't know.
So the British can't go down and get it now because that would expose them as liars. What's their only option at this point?
Leave it there.
And let you get it?
Let no one get it.
And how do they prevent you?
Well, because the U.S. courts told me I could never go back out there and recover it, that Sea Hunters was never allowed to go back out there and recover it. Now, that's crazy in itself.
Legally?
Legally, yes.
And what's something like that legally called? Or...
I don't know for sure. You'd have to talk to my lawyers, but we've had many lawyers on this, it's a never-ending battle because, like I said, Britain has deep pockets. The U.S. government has deep pockets. It's almost impossible to fight them.
Does Greg Brooks have deep pockets?
Greg Brooks has no pockets.
But you still have the claim to it or no?
No, he took the claim away. The courts took the claim away. For what reason, we don't know. We have never been charged with anything. We've never been convicted of everything. We've done our due diligence. There's no legal reason that claim should be taken away from us. None.
How do you get the claim back?
Fight it in court. More legal. More legal monies.
Do you want to?
I want, yes, I'd love to get the claim back, which there's no reason to take it away other than to smear, which the press did. Well, that's a whole different line of thinking there. We got to go that one separately. But yes, I want to get it back and go out there and recover it and pay our investors back, feed the hungry kids of Maine and Haiti, and pay the U.S. government its fair share in taxes and the state of Maine its fair share. So there's multi-millions of dollars could be, everybody could benefit from this.
So with that in mind, knowing that the benefit that would, you know, benefit pretty much everybody involved, even the governments involved, what incentive does the British government and the U.S. government have from keeping you from the wreck? Like, can you speculate as to the reasons they would benefit from not letting you have it, knowing that they can't have it themselves?
And what the only, well, the only thing that I can speculate on why they would not let us go back there is that there was some kind of secret cargo on board, and it's best left down at the bottom of the sea than to let anyone know that it existed. And that's a possibility. But if they had come up to me and told me that, then, you know, maybe we could have worked out something. I had an arrangement with this very wealthy British gentleman who contacted me about the Port Nicholson. And he was willing, he said that if he was convinced that there was something on there, he would put untold monies into this to get it done. He would put whatever it took. If it took $50 million, $100 million, he would supply it. Well, he had a close friend of his who was one of the lords in the House of Commons or whatever over there. I'm not quite sure how their whole system is, but he had someone high up in their government. And they went to the people in charge of any maritime activity, whether it's shipwrecks or anything else, or the financial minister or whatever. And we had a tentative deal to recover the shipwreck with the British government. And so this British billionaire kept on dragging his feet. He actually sent a letter of intent that he was going to do this. And then he talked to my researchers. He's talked to some other people. Then I find out behind my back, him and some of my partners are trying to make a deal amongst themselves and kick me and most of our partners out of this. And that bothered the hell out of me. And I wasn't going to stand for it. So, and he tried to change the deal, the agreement that we made, the verbal agreement that we made. He was going to get a certain percent. Well, he came back and said, well, you know, now that I've got the British government involved and all of this stuff, that he wanted way more percentage. I mean, a huge amount. And I told him no. And I says, well, if you can't agree to it, I don't want, I'm moving on, and I'll go, we'll find someone else, which I did. And then the British deal went away. And they kept on fighting me. So, you know, on the one hand, we'd have a deal if I made a deal. I mean, we'd have a deal with the British government if I made a deal with the British billionaire. But since I don't want to make a deal with the greedy British billionaire, the British government says, well, then we're not going to give you a go-ahead to salvage the shipwreck. We'll just play with you in court until you go away. And then, so of course, the British attorneys, the U.S. British attorneys, their office is right side by side with the Portland Press Herald. Now, the next thing I know, certain parts of depositions, which if anyone knows depositions, you know, I may tell my story, you may tell your story, but your story is a little different than mine because you just view things different, or you're not in the position that I am. So they took pieces of it and filtered it over to the Press Herald, and the Press Herald started printing these things. And then you have one of the reporters of the Press Herald that was looking for some dirty something, and he searched on me and my company. He searched everywhere. He posted in treasure forums and asking people to for dirt on me and my company. Well, they were saying, you know, well, why are you doing that? He says, the people on this forum, and I'll give you a copy, you can take that, said, you know, this guy is pretty good. He says, no, I've got all the good stories you'd ever want. He says, there's tons of good stories. I want to find the bad ones. Now, why would anybody do that? You know, I mean, everything's going along. I'm fighting the British. But now, all of a sudden, the Press Herald is on my case saying that, you know, whatever they said. And, you know, they never even checked their information. They met with my engineers. They met with some people on my crew who audio taped it. And we have copies of the audio tapes and told him the truth. He never printed one word of what they said because it didn't fit what they were trying to do.
How do you think you were portrayed in the press?
Bad, like I was a crook.
And
that I scammed investors. Well, you know, most of the investors I never spoke with because back when we first started getting the ship, I was in Louisiana doing a survey on the ship to see if we would buy it. We didn't have enough money to buy it, but I was down there because I knew that we would. I just had faith in the whole thing. My partner, John Hardy, was up here, and he met with a whole bunch of people and gave them the story about the Port Nicholson. And they wanted to be involved. And, of course, in the beginning, we all thought it was going to take a week, maybe 2 weeks, because, you know, you go out there, there's a shipwreck, let's pull it up, and the end of it. Well, that's not how it turned out. We wished it did, but we found out that, you know, you got currents, you got winds, you got depth, you've got bad visibility, you have waves that would go over the ship. I mean, we found out a lot of things we didn't know because there's no book out there that says, okay, this is how you do it. So, you know, there's people out there that say that they've done some, but in that depth of water at the time, there was a couple people in the world that have done it.
So 2 years out, what do you say to investors who are still there waiting for you to find it?
Well, the people who called me up, I have an open door policy. Anybody who came to me and asked me what was going on, they got the good, bad, and the ugly because that's what it is. I held nothing from them.
So you're an honest person. You'll tell everything as
yes, if you're a partner of ours, I will tell you everything because you can't lie to people because you get caught up in your lies because you can't remember lies. So tell them the truth, whether they like it or not. Just tell them, and which I did. And everybody that, I mean, I still have people that I were talking to today that have been in the get-go and that has actually lent us some money in the past here to keep things going with lawyers and things like that. So they believe in it.
And if you were telling lies, it would be a lot easier to find dirt on you because you could find one moment where you lied and then the papers would be all about that.
Exactly. So, and that will be the next part of that. But and I also had a website for our partners that they could log on with their numbers, their passwords, and I kept it updated. So we didn't hide anything. When we had National Geographic, we had Discovery on board the first year, and they filmed everything. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of video. I mean, I'd love to get this back, but they want to charge us for it because it's taken so long, and it's a contractual thing. But anyways, and then we had National Geographic, 60 Minutes. I gave Nat Geo and 60 Minutes all my documentation, everything that we had on the Port Nicholson. And somewhere in the following months, the head of Nat Geo TV called me up, and she said, you know something? She says, of all the stories we've ever done, you provided the most comprehensive data and research that I've ever seen. So I was pretty proud of that because I was hiding nothing. Now, if I was going to do anything wrong or did anything wrong, why would I give them every bit of my data? Because they're putting their researchers on it, too. And I wanted them to, because that was digging up information for us to help us. So I never hid anything. If you were the partner and asked the question, I would give you the answer. Now, what happened was Bill Green did a short piece. He called me up and asked if I would give my side of it. My attorney said, don't talk to the press because they'll just twist it and turn it, which they do. So I didn't say anything to Bill Green. But one of his best friends is Denny Denham, who was the guy that was on the show that was saying that I was a crook and everything. Denny Denham hasn't called me or talked to me in at least seven years. I haven't heard from him. I didn't know if he was alive or dead. So how does, I mean, he's accusing, but he never called up to ask anything.
What are some things he would accuse you for, and what would you say to them?
He said that he implicated that some of the wrecks, like in Florida, that we had a contract for, and that was another one. We found a wreck which we believe was the Notre Dame de Deliverance. Now, him and a couple of their experts said there was never a ship called the Notre Dame de Deliverance. Well, Google it. All you have to do is Google it, and you'll find at least two. One was up in Louisburg, Nova Scotia. It was captured by the British. It's well documented. The other one, it was one that was a French vessel. So it was well documented. But if you just say it and you don't do your research on it, people just believe it.
Why would people want to report bad things about you?
Well, because I wasn't giving them a reply in their story. And so we had Denny sitting there saying that, I made up this stuff. Well, I never made up anything. It was the Notre Dame de Deliverance. We did have an arrest on it down in Florida, off the Florida Keys. And part of it was in the Marine Sanctuary, and part of it was outside. And then somebody in the leftover from the Clinton era that came into, I don't know who that was, we'll leave that away. But anyways, they contacted Spain and had Spain file suit against us. It wasn't even a Spanish ship. It was a French vessel, French cargo vessel. But Spain claimed it because it had Spanish cargo on board. And Spain, this attorney Gould out of Washington, D.C., he descended upon us. And at the time, we're still a poor company from Maine trying to do this stuff. And we found it. We spent our money finding it. And then the big guns come in. And nobody wants to invest in legal drama. And so we had to leave it and had to give up on it. And it's like, you can't fight countries. They have too deep of pockets, so you just can't fight them.
And you're easy pickings for them.
Oh, yeah. I'm still that little guy from Maine, Greg, you know.
I think you should mention that Denny wasn't even in this project. He was from a former project.
Right. Well, backed it up. The guy that did the story with Bill Green that said that all of this stuff, he wasn't even in this project, but he started this for whatever reason. I have no idea. But he never contacted me. But he was in with us on the project in Florida. And when the Spanish government came and started on us, we couldn't fight them. So we backed out of it. So we knew that our partners at that time lost out. So we took all of them, wrote up a contract, had our attorneys write up a contract, and brought them into the Port Nicholson so that they would get a share of that. And our attorney says, you don't have to do that. And both my partner, John Hardy, and myself said, yes, we do. It's the right thing to do. He says, but legally, you don't have to do that. You're going to give them a lot of money for nothing. I said, no. They helped us when we needed it then. We brought them forward into this. And so everybody was aware of that. But none of them, like I said, these people would not call. We hadn't. They didn't reach out one bit. So
that's an interesting point about your investors. What do you think your responsibility is to your investors?
My is to do my due diligence and do the best that I can to get this recovered. Now, everybody got a hold of a private placement memorandum, and it's 100 and something pages long, and it gives the pros and cons and the risk factors. And there's a huge big list of risk factors, like governments may come in, we may run out of money, just all the risk factors that you can think of. Everybody signed up for that because you have to do that because it's, you have to tell them that it's very risky. We may not have the right equipment. A salvage boat may sink. The government may come in and take it away from us and all of these things, which, it turns out to be true. So I've done what I could with what I had to work with. If I had a little bit more to work with, we would have got this accomplished. But I didn't have it. I tried, and I kept trying, and I kept trying. And I'm still fighting to this day. But, it's pretty hard when you have two dimes to rub together to do it. But
compare investing in you to investing in another market or another field?
Like risk versus reward. Stock market, yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you looked at an investment in Shipwreck, it's a very high risk, but the rewards are extremely high too. Because we'll just use this as an example. If you had, let's say, $10,000 in this, you probably would get $1 million back. So there's high risk, but there's a good chance you're going to lose that 10. But when you read the prospectus, you heard what everyone had to say, you've watched the videos, you've seen our evidence, and you get in, it's not for everyone. Some people won't even talk to you about it, but other people are wicked excited about this because it's history. I mean, we've dug up so much history on this that nobody knew about on the Port Nicholson and the Cherokee. And so it's very... very risky, but the rewards can be astronomical. Some of our investors actually went out to the site and spent some time with us, and they loved it. They thought it was the most fascinating thing in the world.
And you actually care about them.
Oh, yes. I nothing would make me happier than bring up all this gold, and here's yours, and here's my little piece, and we all got little piles of it, and we did what we said we was going to do. Yes, it means a lot.
We should cut.